So today my talk is on, it's the Christian's relationship with the world. There's basically, this is the entire outline. Distinct, called out, which shows that we need to have faith, exemplified with Daniel. Our relationship with the world is one of being exemplary and light, with the emphasis on purity, illustrated through the three that were thrown into the fire. A relationship with the world is hostile, persecution with the emphasis on endurance. We're going to look at how Saul was hunted by David. And then evangelism, gospel, with the emphasis on loving the world, and of course, illustrating with Jesus himself. So this is a graphic I put together, and it sort of emphasizes the first point, and that is the idea of being called out. Now, we're familiar with the passage, come out from among them and be ye separate. What's interesting is this particular idea transcends the entire Bible. It starts with Noah being called out of the world and into the ark. It continues forward with Lot being called out of Sodom, because Sodom was going to be destroyed. You know, the earth was destroyed with water. Sodom was destroyed by fire. Then you come forward and you've got the language of come out from among them and be ye separate. You know, right there in the Assyrian captivity of 732 BC. And, 732 BC, when the Assyrians came and took away the 10 northern tribes, it's used specifically of, literally and specifically of Babylon, you know, when they were coming out of captivity, come out of Babylon. Of course, that's the primary type that this whole concept of being coming out of the world comes from. What's interesting is Daniel himself, you can see here that at the time of 605 B.C., I'm just going to bring this up so you can see it. 605 BC. This is the beginning of the Assyrian captivity. Think of Daniel's life as a stopwatch for the captivity. It began in 605 when he entered captivity, and it ended in 536 BC when he tapped Cyrus on the shoulder and said, "Hey, guy, I got something to show you." And he pulls out Isaiah 45 and says, "Hey, look, here's your name. How'd that happen? You know, 200 years before." And so that's what motivated Cyrus likely to issue the decree. And we have found the cylinder, Cyrus's cylinder, which emancipated the entire world to go home, not just the Jews. What's interesting is when you come to the period of Daniel in 605, that Jeremiah the prophet was active. Uriah, as you can see up here in 609, he's active. He was killed by Jehoiakim. But the whole idea of coming out is exactly what was told to the people. And basically, you've got in Jeremiah multiple places in the era of the three attacks that Nebuchadnezzar did on Jerusalem in 605, 597, and 587, those three periods of time, Jeremiah was active all the way through down to 561 BC. But all through this period, the message of all the prophets was, look, come out of the city, get out of Jerusalem, because the curses of Babylon have been transferred to Jerusalem, and the blessings of Jerusalem are now in Babylon. That's where you need to go for safety. The city's going to be destroyed. There's no way to escape this. And so we have passages like, you know, Jeremiah 21:8, that says, you shall say to this, it was spoken specifically to Zedekiah, you shall say to this people, thus says the Lord, behold, I set before you the way of life and death. He who dwells in this city will die by the sword and by famine and pestilence, but he who goes out and falls away to the Chaldeans or the Babylonians are, who are besieging you will live, and you will have your own life as a booty. I've set my face against this city for harm and not for good, declares the Lord, and I also given, so it's going to be burnt with fire. So, you know, when Daniel in 605 was captured, he wasn't really captured. You know, he was, you know, not a POW, as is an interesting modern piece of news that's happening right now. You know, he just walked out and surrendered. which is even worse, to the enemy. They didn't hunt Daniel down and find him in the basement, in the cellar. Daniel and the three, Meshach, Meshach, and Abednego, they went out, all four of them, with about 4,000 others, as it says in Jeremiah, and surrendered, literally surrendered. And that's, why did they do that? Because God, it was the, all through history, there had been a whole series of culls. You know, we know about the 23,000 fell in one day, and they were destroyed by the destroyer, 1 Corinthians 10. And we know, historically, there were many, periods of time in the wilderness that these would die, that would die. When the ark was captured and it showed up at Beth Shemesh, 36,000 died right there because they looked into the ark. At the time of Jeroboam, when there was a war between him and Rehoboam, 500,000 of the Israelites of the north died. And this one here, of the 6 million that inhabited Israel, there's really only going to be about 8,000 or 10,000 that are going to survive this entire purge. Because, and when they came out of Babylonian captivity, once for all, they were no longer idol worshippers. Hooray, finally, they got the diapers off. So what we've got then is they went out, and Daniel surrenders, and we find that that's the message. Well, a few years later, in 597, what happens? Jehoiakim himself also goes out and surrenders. This is the Kaniah of prophecy that's in the bloodline of Christ. You know, oh, earth, 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 none of his descendants will rule in Judea on earth anymore. And of course, we like using that verse to show premillennialism is wrong. But the key here is this is the young 8-year-old king, and he was 8, not 18, and he actually marched out. And there may be a deep deja vu, because when Nebuchadnezzar, you know, remembered Josiah, the great reformer, was 8 years old, and look what he did. This other guy, maybe this is, you know, deja vu with Jehoiakim, so he, took him out of service, and that's when Zedekiah came into being. But he went out and surrendered. It says that, you know, Jehoiah went out to the king of Babylon. He, his mother, which was the wife of Jehoiakim, and his servants and his captains and his officials, and the king of Babylon took him captive in the 8th year of his reign, the 8th year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. And many times the same thing was true. Zedekiah was ordered multiple times to surrender. We also find this language, interestingly, throughout the New Testament. You know, you look at the book of Revelation, and I've, you know, been preaching 35 years, never could figure out Revelation. What on earth is this book all about? And as I was going through the survey, it struck me, Revelation is John's Olivet discourse on the destruction of Jerusalem. You know, John never talked about the destruction of Jerusalem. We always say, well, actually he did. He wrote a whole book on it. And so I've come to the firm position that it was written in 66 without being controversial. But the point I'm trying to make to you, when you go to the book of Revelation, and I will be writing a commentary on this in about a year, and you go to the book of Revelation, all you need to do is when you see the great harlot or you see, Babylon, you just replace that with the word Jerusalem and you've got it figured out. And we find that in the book of Revelation, this language of come out of Babylon is used, but there's very many hints that this is a symbolic, call, is a spiritual call, and the Christians understood it. You've got, in the city of Jerusalem, you know, you've got language like this is the forehead written on the name is a mystery city. It's a mystery. You know, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots. So we know that's not what it really was. And you've got the language of, you know, there's seven kings and six have fallen, one is, whatever. And of course that, if you start with Julius and leaving Julius out, and if you leave Julius out, you'll end up with 96. If you put Julius Caesar in, and that's like leaving, who's your first president again? Can't remember. First president. Yeah, leaving him out, you know. Thank you. And, so, you know, it's Nero. The now is, has to be Nero. It's impossible for it to be anybody else. But the key is it has a passage like this found in Revelation 11, 1 to 8. It says their dead bodies will lie in the street, the great city, which is the harlot, which is Babylon, which is mystically called Sodom and Egypt. Boom. Now that's actually the phrase that made me realize what the book of Revelation was about, because I'd just done an extensive survey on Jeremiah and seen that that's exactly what Jerusalem was called in 587. Come out from among them. The language is used in 587, multiple times by Jeremiah. Not exactly that language, but the same exact message. And Jeremiah says, Jerusalem in 587, it's going to be destroyed. Why? Because it has become like Sodom and it's become like Egypt. Both Ezekiel and Jeremiah use this kind of phraseology. So when you come to the book of Revelation and you see that both cities were destroyed on the same day of the year, the 10th of Av, A-V, you know, we know from the Bible it says the 10th of Av, or from Josephus, 70 A.D., and we know that both the people that destroyed Nebuchadnezzar was a crown prince, and so was Titus a crown prince. In the same year their fathers died, and they became king. The echo is just unmistakable. The connection is simply unmistakable, especially since what literally happened, and was literally said in 587 B.C., was that the transference of Babylon, the reversal of Babylon and Jerusalem. And so you find that for us, we have this kind of language where it says, you know, we are strangers and aliens on the earth. Our citizenship is in heaven. We have language which says, for the gospel message, 2 Corinthians 6:17, which was the primary text that would be connected with the lesson that we're talking about here. And that would be, you know, come out from their midst and be separate. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will welcome you. And what you've got here then is, you know, the end of the world. We all know the end of the world, whenever that's going to happen. The whole gospel message that we preach, our relationship with the world is saying to them, come out from among them. It's not Noah. It's not Lot. It's not the 10 tribes in the north. It's not Jerusalem 587. It's not the Jews of the first century, all of whom were told to come out. This is the general message we preach to the world, because all those previous things I mentioned are going to be destroyed, and the world is going to be destroyed. So we are become a Christian and vacate the earth and become a citizen in heaven. And that's what the whole message is all about here, is the idea. Then we've got, we've got all the passages we're familiar with. We're aliens and strangers on the earth. The idea in Hebrews 11 that, you know, Abraham died in faith and he was looking for a heavenly kingdom, and that kingdom was whose maker was God. It's heaven. It's the spiritual presence of God. And we recognize then that we've got passages like Acts 2:40. It says, be saved from this perverse generation. Be saved from the world. Come out. You know, the whole idea of coming out on the day of Pentecost, it says those that received his word were baptized. Come out. Well, what does the word ecclesia mean in the Greek? It means the called out. So the whole idea of our relationship with the world is to go out and say to them, look, the earth is going to be destroyed. Come out from the world, join the saved, be baptized, become part of the body of Christ. You know, Galatians 3:27. Become baptized, added to the body, and escape the coming destruction. Refuge is in the heavenly Jerusalem right now. It's interesting that in Psalm 110:3, it says, you know, your people will volunteer freely in the day of your power, the Messiah. That's exactly what happened to Daniel. You know, he volunteered freely. He came out. And what did Daniel have to do? You know, he had to go out, walk out, leave everything. This is before Nebuchadnezzar had first attacked in 605. And the prophet says, Daniel, you're one of my most faithful. God has instructed us to surrender. Oh, wow. What about my house? What about my motorbike? What about my Bluetooth, my computer and all the stuff I've got? Just leave it. Your life is your booty. You're sure that's what God said? Yep. Okay. And he walks out. That's the kind of faith that Christians need to have. That's what we are called to do. You know, pick up your cross, deny yourself, and follow Jesus. The idea of surrender. And that's, for example, 2 Corinthians 4:17, momentary light affliction is producing for us a weight of glory far beyond all comparison. We not look at the things that we can see. We focus on the unseen things. You know, just like Daniel was called out to a place he didn't know. What's this going to be like in Babylon? Wow, he may have never been there. He was only 15 years old. It echoes Abraham called out to a place he didn't know. And it echoes us being called to a heaven. How many people know what an angel looks like? How many people know what heaven looks like? We don't know. The entire place, heaven and hell, are described in a series of metaphors. You know, it's a garden, it's lava, it's sunlight, it's whatever. We don't know because God can't describe it. We are called to the unknown, and it takes people of faith to obey that. And that's what we do here. So whether it be Noah, Lot, Jerusalem twice, or us today, that's what we need to be. The second point is that we need to be exemplary light, exemplary light. And, you know, you've got the idea. I love the passage in John. Our relationship with the world is to shed light in the darkness, is to shine where there is no light. We are beacons of light, and Christ is the great light, of course. It says, this is judgment, or this is how the judgment works. Light comes into the world, and men love darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light. He does not come to the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed, but he who practices the truth comes to the light so that his deeds may be manifest in God. You know, Philippians 2:15, we're to be blameless, children of God above reproach, among whom you peer, a perverse and crooked generation, as lights in the world. They know what it's like when you wake up in a strange house, like I've done all week, and it's pitch black, and you have no idea how to make it to the bathroom at 3 a.m. You know, I still have a bruise on my head, but it's nice to have a light. Now, actually, they did. I'm just kind of making that up, but that's the whole point. We know what I'm talking about. When you are in a place you don't know, and all of a sudden, how terrible it must be to be physically blind, for example. Well, the world is totally blind, and we are shedding light on a path, and the world doesn't know the path, and we say, don't go that way, don't go that way, go this way, or go that way, or that way. We can tell you how to go, and stop, don't take another foot, don't take another step. And so what we find here is, it says, 1 Peter 4:3, the time already passed is sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles, and etc., not to be involved in their sin. And when we don't, and they see it, they see the difference, and they malign us. So the idea is we are to be pure. Our light is there as an example, and it's to be pure light. 1 John 2, and this is, you know, a central key verse in the theme I've been assigned. Do not love the world, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. And all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. The world is passing away, also with its lusts, etc. And so what we find here is there's a fantastic passage found in Matthew 4. It's one of my favorite passages. And I've actually stood in the very place where Jesus said this. So Jesus heard that John would be taken into captivity. He withdrew into Galilee. And, of course, here is Galilee up here. You can see up in the north area. Where am I here? Here into Galilee. Leaving Nazareth, so here's Nazareth, leaving Nazareth, he went over and settled in Capernaum, which is just up here, by the sea, in the region of Zebulun and Naphtali. There's Naphtali and there's Zebulun, the green text. Those are the tribal names. And then it says, this was to fulfill, now here's the prophecy of Jesus. The people who were sitting in darkness saw a great light. And those who were sitting in the land of the shadow of death, upon them a light dawned. And from that time on, Jesus began to preach, repent, the kingdom of God is at hand. Now, what's so fantastic about this is that Jesus is called the morning star. But in fact, Jesus is not the only star in the only morning star in the Bible. There is another morning star, which is antitypical of the devil, even though it's specifically the king of Babylon. You know, the Lucifer passage literally means the morning star, the shining one. And that language, so what God does is the light and the message of the gospel, there's always wheat among the tares, there's always garbage among the flowers, there's always, there's two morning stars, there's two apparent sources of light, but we need to know which one to follow when we need to follow the true morning star, not the counterfeit light that the world seems to think that they can follow. And so when we look at this, we see that when it comes to purity and being pure, morally pure, etc., put it this way, there's three types of people that won't commit fornication. There's the first that say, hey, you know, is there anybody watching? I wouldn't want anybody at church next time I'm up doing the Lord's Supper knowing that, you know, I slept with a woman other than someone or a man other than I'm married to. Fornication. And the second person says, ha, you're such a child, and you're thinking, don't you know God sees everything? That's still diapers. The real approach is the third type of person that says, I'm not going to do that because that is who I am. I don't care if God is watching. I don't care if my brothers are watching. I won't do that because that's who I am, and that's the kind of people that God is looking for. Take the training wheels off. You know, young people, I'll tell you something. Sex is a very powerful thing, and it's like a Russian, it's like playing Russian roulette with a five shooter. In Canada, under 35, and I'm sure it's the same in the States, one in five people under the age of 40 have an STD, and some of them are, you can't be cured from them, quite a few of them, and it just really ruins your future with another person. One in five. So the next time, you know, you're out there and, you know, it's just you and that person, you think, oh, you know, and you think, oh boy, it's great. It feels good. Do I want to do this? Oh, nobody will find out. Just think about the gun, five bullets. One of them is an STD, and you don't put it at your temple. You put it between your legs. You shoot. And if it's an STD, you're cooked. It's a very dangerous thing. It says in 1 Corinthians 6:18, flee immorality. Every other sin that a man commits outside is outside the body, but the immoral man sins against his own body. Do you think STDs are new? No, it's been going on all the time. It's a very dangerous thing. Purity, the world notices. And of course God notices. Now a great example here of this kind of exemplary purity is found in Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And I think it's here. Yes. So we know in 605 that, you know, Daniel surrendered along with the three. And in 2 years later in 603, oh, by the way, 605 is Daniel 1:1. 603 is when they didn't eat the vegetables and they were okay and they entered the king's service. That's 603. 602 is Daniel 2, verse 1, the vision of the statue of the, you know, Medo Persia, Greece, Rome, the four kingdoms. That's Daniel 2, verse 1. That's 602 BC. And then what you find is, Daniel 3, you can see here, the building of the, this big, great statue that is 90 feet tall in Daniel 3. Why did he spend 7 years building this great statue in Daniel chapter 3? Because he was so impressed with his vision and the interpretation from Daniel chapter 2, they followed one in hand. In fact, he started building this the very same year. And the result is that 7 years later, in 595, we can see that Nebuchadnezzar, in Daniel chapter 3, verse 2, invites all the heads of state to come to Babylon. Remember, he's the king of the world. Every other nation is submitted to him. Now, here's how it would work. You'd have something like this. You know, you have a great statue. You know, there it is. And the heads of state, there's maybe only 15 or 20 heads of state in his regional control. And they would all have the front row seat right close to it. And then as the lower ranking people and then the common people would be far back, you know, maybe a kilometer away. There would be probably a million people, half a million people, a large group at this statue. And what happens? We know the story. The bugle trumps and the lyres and all the stuff, and everybody's supposed to fall down and worship the statue when the command came. And everybody at the front, they all bowed, and the king was happy. He looked around and he saw everybody there who was standing before the statue bowed. And all of a sudden he hears, what's this? There's these three, Shadrach and these guys, they won't bow? So the king goes down and he says, is it true? And these are his trusted officials. These are his friends, his advisors. Is it true? And he said, and so the three of them said, if it be so, God, this is Daniel 3:14. If it be so, God, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of the fiery blaze. And he will deliver us out of your hand too, king. But even if he does not, and I just love, they're probably looking right in the eye. It's probably the taunting. You know what? Even if, better put this back. Even if he does not, we're not going to worship your idol. And the king, you know what happened? His face went all contorted and he gets angry and the furnace gets hot and they throw them in and one of them dies throwing him in. And in there, the angel, probably the same angel that saved Daniel from the lion's den, we don't know, but an angel saved them. And the king is just, what? What's this all about? And pulls them out and, you know, the hair and there's no smell and there's no singeing. And he is stunned by the miracle. And he says, there's no God that can save like this. And he issues a proclamation. But then what does he do? he calls the heads of state. Remember the heads of state? He calls the heads of state, come over here. And it's all in the text. I don't have time to do it now, but all the heads of state, come on over to the furnace of fire. And they're, okay, what's this all about? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Yeah, okay, so what? Who are they? Said, well, I just threw them in, and an angel saved them. And I want to let you know, you heads of state, that any one of you that say anything against their God, Yahweh, he's cooked. And there's no God that can save anywhere of all our gods that can save like that. Who is one of the heads of state? Zedekiah. Did you know that? Jeremiah 51, Zedekiah and Seraiah, the chief scribe, made a trip to Babylon in the fourth year of Zedekiah. It's all there. This is what's happening here. Zedekiah had just bowed to the statue, and three of his own subjects that had the faith to surrender, you know, 16 years earlier, were the ones that converted the world. And so now we have this great idea of exemplary light. The whole world is bowing to this false statue. Even the king of Israel, who sits on the very throne of God himself, had bowed to the statue. We know he did. We know he was there. And we know he bowed because if he didn't, he'd have had his head cut off right there. They were the only three in the whole kingdom, including the other captive Jews, apparently, that wouldn't do it. That is what exemplary light is all about, shining when the whole world is dark, in spite of what might happen to you. Beloved, do not be surprised, 1 Peter 4:12, at the fiery ordeal that comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you, but the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing. So our relationship with the world is just like these three. Jesus said, you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor does a lamp shine when it's put under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. So the idea is, this isn't about evangelism. I'm getting there. This is about purity of living, which doesn't disqualify your message of evangelism. And that's what they did. They had this incredibly pure life. And remember, I could go on this, but remember, they tried to find some fault in these guys, and they couldn't find any fault. They were perfect. All the others were corrupt. They had an exemplary life in the Babylonian kingdom. The third story here is the idea of hostile persecution. Endurance. And in John 15 and 18, it says, if the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it's hated you. And if you were in the world would love its own. You know how Christians, we're increasingly under attack. We've had gay marriage for 10 years. I stood before an audience of 350 and led the prayer, and I read the top 10 reasons why we must oppose gay marriage in front of an entire city audience. And, you know, it's over. It's here, and you've got the Supreme Court making proclamations. The world's gone mad. Like, what's going on here? Well, what's happened is Jesus said, look, if you were of the world would love its own. But you're not of the world because I called you out of the world. I chose you out of the world. And because of this, the world hates you. You're just not one of their guys. You don't run with them. It's like school kid stuff. Well, you're not my friend, so I'm not yours. It's that simple. That's what Jesus kind of said. John 17, I have given them your word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, even as I am of the world. I do not ask in his prayer. I do not ask you to take them out of the world, but to keep them from the evil one. And so that shows us our position. We're stuck in the midst of the muck. We're knee high in the septic tank. You know, we're up to here in the septic tank of the world, and we have to do our best to tread water to keep ourselves clean from this. And Jesus said, they are not of the world, nor am I of the world. Sanctify them in truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I have sent them into the world. So our mission and our goal is to be recognized that we are to be in the world, and the world will attack us and the world will persecute us. The idea that we are, you know, essentially hated without a cause. We know that Satan is the ruler of this world. You know, John 12:13. Now, when we look at an example here of being hated for absolutely no reason, we can see that Saul, you know, Saul was born in 1082. You can see that Saul was born in 1082, and at the age of 15, when Saul was 15, he had Jonathan was born, and age 30, we know Saul became king, and he had a son who was 15 years old named Jonathan, and we know that he single-handedly conquered the garrison at Michmash, scaled the walls with his armor bearer at age 15, and conquered the Philistine garrison. The very faith that he had was incredible. It was as great as King David's faith. Jonathan is an unsung hero of the Old Testament. And now you go forward, 12 years later, in 1040, David is born, and then in 1025, David, at age 15 himself, is anointed by Samuel, who later that year kills Goliath in a spectacular display of faith. And while they stood there, you know, on that mount at the Elah Valley, and he's holding the head of Goliath, and somebody's got the sword there for him, that is when Jonathan came up to him, and that is at that point that their souls were knit together in love. Now, why was that? That's because Jonathan, who had seen him in the palace many times, suddenly noticed, that's the same kind of faith I had when I was that age. And did you notice that for all the times Saul tried to kill David so he couldn't become king, at that very moment, Jonathan abdicated his royal crown prince to David by giving him his robe, giving him his sword, giving him all his stuff. And there was a number of, about four or five times, Jonathan and him made a commitment that, you know, you'll be king, David, and I will be at your side. I will never try to be king. Jonathan was an incredible person. And so all this drove Saul crazy, and of course, that's exactly what happened. He had a period of reign. God took the kingdom away from him. He got angry. And the result was that God withdrew the spirit from Saul, and it rested on David. And Saul knew that he no longer had the spirit, and he knew that David had the spirit. And so, you know, the second time, he throws the spear, and David escapes. David is now on the run for 4 years, from 1018 to 1018 to 1014. Saul hunts David, and what we've got here in this is, you know, he's up here. Here's the palace. Here's Jerusalem, and up here, this is Gibeah of Benjamin, or Gibeah of Saul. This is the same place in Judges 19 where the The priest's wife was cut up into pieces. The sodomite harlotry that resulted in the extinction of Benjamin saved 600 people in 1340 BC. But what happened here is Gibeah of Benjamin saw David fled the palace, and he goes down to Nob, and that's where he ate the consecrated bread, and then Saul kills all the priests, and then David then flees over to Gath to take refuge from the king of Gath, and then when that didn't work, he had to flee, faking insanity, he took his mother and father, and he fled over here, the same place that Ruth had gone to Kiriath Harish, or the Mizpah of Moab, the capital city of Moab, that's where Ruth went a couple of generations before. And while he's standing there, the prophet Gad comes along and goes, "What? And what do you want?" And he says, "Get back to Judah." And David, being a righteous man, obeyed the prophet. He was basically finding refuge, not under the wings of God, like he wrote many times in the psalm that he learned after this effect, but he was taking refuge under the wings of a pagan king. He went back and was obedient, and he was chased all over this area here, all over this area. And we know that, he was able to grab the spear and cut the robe and all that stuff. But there's one main event it's really a centerpiece of messianic literature in the Old Testament, right here at the Rock of Escape, this little triangle. This is Saul's little self-praise monument that he built. And what happened is, the story goes like this. Saul had been the Ziphites, right here, the town of Ziph, right here. They had ratted David out three times, and this is the third and final time. And what happens is, they said, "Hey, we know where David is." And he said, "Oh, how blessed you are." And so he comes straight down, and he's happy with the Ziphites, but David's at the Rock of Escape over here. He's on a mountain, which is... And so David's here, and Saul's over here, and the passage actually says in 1 Samuel 23:26 that as David went around one side of the mountain, Saul was going around the other side, and then Saul, even though he's wicked, was still a good army commander, and then he split the forces, and they're coming around both ways, and David was going to be caught. Now, there's two psalms written when David was in the cave, when he cut the robe of Saul when he was sleeping. The first psalm was when he thought he was captured. And the second psalm was when he realized God had delivered him. The same thing true here about the Rock of Escape. There was one psalm written, a series of psalms written, of how David felt when he knew he was cooked, he knew he was captured, and he knew that he was going to be killed by Saul right there on that mountain. He knew it was over. He'd lost. He was captured. And there's a second psalm of when God delivered him. How did David escape that little incident? Remember, a runner came and said, "Hey, Saul, the Philistines have attacked just up north just up north. And up here at Keilah is where they attacked. The attack took place." And so Saul, he had already defended Keilah once, and, they're his buddies. So he called off the attack and said, "Oh, I'll get you later," and came up. But guess what is happening here? During the 4 years, remember the prophet says, "Get over to Judah." This is when David wrote close to 35 psalms during this four-year period under intense persecution, hated without a cause. He wrote that. Where else have you heard that? "They hated me without a cause." And who is one of the descendants of David that was applied to? And, you've got a statement in the psalms at this very same time: "Commit yourself to the Lord, deliver him from the Lord, let him rescue him because he delights in him." That's basically David penning the voice of Saul. That's what Saul was saying of David. "Ha! I lost the spirit. You got it. You think you're so super spiritual with your harp. You think you're so great, David, and God's with you. Ha! I got you now. Who's going to deliver you now?" And then third and finally, when David realized he was captured in the psalm, he said, my God, why have you forsaken me?" That's where this happened, right here. And so we have this fantastic archetype, messianic archetype, right here at this Rock of Escape. They hated me without a cause. My God, why have you forsaken me?" All the while, Saul voicing, "Ha, commit yourself." And that's what the soldier said at the cross of Jesus. The final point The final point is obviously the text at hand, which I'm supposed to be talking about in part, and that's Mark 16, 15, and 16. You know, go into all the world, preach the gospel to all creation. He who has believed and has been baptized shall be saved, but he who has disbelieved shall be condemned. And we find that the fourth point here is evangelism, gospel, with an emphasis on loving. And we see that Jesus sums up all of the above. You know, Jesus was distinct. He was called out. His own family mocked him. The world mocked him. The world thought he was crazy. Hey, Jesus, your parents have come with the loony bin people. They're going to haul you off to Bedlam. Everybody thinks you're crazy. His hometown rejected him. You know, he was hated without a cause. Why are you stoning me? Why do you attack me? What sin have I done? You know, and he was exemplary light. And, you know, we've got the idea here, of course, that Jesus is the ultimate morning star, as we touched upon a little bit earlier. And, you know, we see that in this particular outline that there's a time when we have to recognize that being a Christian and being in the world isn't an easy thing. We need to be distinct, exemplary, hostile, recognize that it's hostile, and yet with all this attack, we're going out and trying to lead the world that's attacking us, mocking us, we're trying to lead them to Christ. It's kind of like the old saying that, you know, the definition of forgiveness or the definition of evangelism is the perfume that a flower leaves on the heel that crushed it. And so, you know, I leave you with this, Daniel 12, verse 3. It says, and this is one of my all-time favorite verses. When I'm alone, I think of this verse because I think this is our mission. It says, those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, and those who lead the many to righteousness will shine like the stars forever and ever. And I went to the NASA 3D thing, IMAX, and of course it's a Canadian invention. We invented it in 1967, but, you know, all these stars, and when you see the expanse of the stars, you know, that's us. Every one of us are one of those stars. And the problem is, and what's happening today, you know, you go through the city, it's almost like a comedy act seeing what churches are doing. It's almost like, I'm glad to come down once in a while. And by the way, that is, seriously, this isn't a joke, because I haven't been at FC in 8 years. That's the best singing I've heard in 8 years. Hey, God bless you. I just thoroughly enjoyed it. I don't hear that. You know what I mean? We got like 10, 15 people. Wow, it's great. But on that's the good side. The bad side is going through all the millions of churches and, you know, we've got dances and binks, all the different stuff they're doing. How they're falling over themselves, trying to outdo themselves with something that has nothing to do with religion. Our job and our mandate is summed up in all of this lesson with 2 Timothy 4, 1-5. I solemnly charge you in the presence of God and Christ, who is to deliver the living and the dead by his appearing, by his kingdom. And there's the judgment. There's the called out. Preach the word, be ready, in season, out of season, reprove, rebuke, exhort with great patience and instruction. The time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, wanting to have their ears tickled. They will gather for themselves people that will put on bake sales and raffles and all this crazy stuff that has nothing to do with religion. And they'll start ordaining women and ordaining gays, and they'll start letting women have place, and they'll start teaching theistic evolution and, you know, questioning the canon, instrumental music, you know, having contemporary worship services. Where does it end? Well, judgment. That's where it ends, I guess, because the wheat among the tares. And they will accumulate accordance with their own desires, their own teachers, will turn away their ears from the truth and turn aside to myths. But you be sober in all things, endure hardship, do the work of an evangelist, fulfill your ministry. Each one of us are to fulfill our ministry to the world. We are to be distinct, recognize that we are the church. And you know, for us, if you're not a Christian today, the whole message of being called out of the world is to be called into the church, which is the group of the called out. And you get that way by being baptized. You're baptized into the church, baptized into the body. If you believe in Jesus, will confess him before men, are prepared to live exemplary light and purity and say, I don't care if you're watching. I don't care if God's watching. That's who I am. I'm not going to do those sins. And if you're prepared to endure, those that live godly will be persecuted, then what on earth are you waiting for? You know, escape the fiery judgment that is to come. From Noah to Lot, two destructions, the end of the world. Make it happen. Let somebody know that you want to be immersed in water today and rise in the newness of life and gain citizenship in heaven. Thank you.